Investing Simplified is brought to you by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisory firm. Price Financial Group has been doing estate planning since 1970 and investment and retirement planning since 1975. Individual situations may vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual professional advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Investing Simplified is the longest-running live financial program with a certified financial planner, estate planning attorney, and a certified public accountant to answer your questions for free. Got a tough real estate tax or financial problem keeping you up at night? Ask your questions free at InvestingSimplifiedRadio.com. That's InvestingSimplifiedRadio.com. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Bo Caldwell.
We do Investing Simplified.
Welcome into Investing Simplified. However you're listening, thank you for making us a part of your day. As a reminder, if you miss the show or miss parts of the show, we do rebroadcast via podcast, whether that's iTunes, Apple Music, Google Play, iHeartRadio, wherever you get your podcasts. We do put the episodes up there for free in your listening pleasure. If you have a question that's been keeping you up at night, whether it's about your finances, about your taxes, about your estate planning, any and all of the above, you'd like one of our experts to answer here on the air for you, please send that to AskBo, A-S-K-B-O, at pfgwm.com. We're happy to answer that for you. With me in studio today is Matt Sudol. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Bo.
We're going to have Taylor Cattell joining us a little bit later in studio to talk through all things estate planning for her Cover Your Assets segment. But right now, Matt, I wanted to talk a little bit about the market this week, right? We've had some good news coming out on the vaccine front. We got the first shipments here in Oregon this last week where the vaccines are being shipped out. We've got some good news in the market as the election starts to filter out. It looks like markets are feeling pretty comfortable with the direction that the country's going, maybe on the coronavirus front, maybe on the election front. It feels like people are starting to get their feet underneath them. It seems like the market is looking pretty bullish. We crossed 30,000 in the Dow again this week.
Yeah, and stayed over 30,000. Yeah, so you know, we were talking about digesting the information. I think that's obviously still happening, but I think the market's okay with the you know, facts that are coming out. So we don't have a lot of ups and downs. It's just kind of steady, holding steady is probably a good term. Just
right, holding steady, not you know, setting anything on fire. I know when we've had, you know, Matt Mahan here, our CIO, he's been talking about some economists that we follow are calling for, you know, a super bullish 2021. I think I tamper that down a little bit. Generally speaking, Chuck used to do his what do we call it, a crystal ball projection for the next
year.
Yeah, for the following year. And I think continuing in that vein, I think we do see high single digits, maybe even a double digit return in 2021. But what people seem to forget just even so recently is that double digit return, even if we get 5, 10, 15% return in the stock market, doesn't come without its, you know, downs along with those ups, right? People so soon forget that we crossed all-time highs in September and then dropped through October and then crossed all-time highs again and then dropped again. And so it can be quite the roller coaster.
Right. It doesn't just go from A, B in a straight line. It would be much easier for everybody if we just didn't have to worry about it. But at the same time, like we talked about a couple of episodes ago, I think, you know, the information is being published to us every second of every day.
Right.
So that's why, you know, it's moving and people are buying and people are selling. And so that's what makes the market move. If all we did is bought on January 1 and then sold on December 31st or something, then we would have only a couple points of reference. But
right,
it's a lot more happening. So,
well, I think it makes sense then to really analyze when you're buying those companies, if you are buying stocks or investing in the stock market, not trying to, again, it comes back to not trying to time the market. Doesn't mean you can't try to have some timing in the market, but making sure that you're not buying thinking that this is, you know, you want to try and time the bottom exactly or time the top exactly, right? Because if you're buying a stock that you believe in long term, then that maybe means that you shouldn't, you know, try to get the perfect entry. If you're holding on to that stock because you believe that company is good long term, then you should be buying it when you have the money available, right? When you can buy it, let's invest in it. You want to get in that company. And then you know that, hey, I own that company. And if it drops, if you still believe in that company, buy more.
Yeah, buy more and just build out your position. It'll kind of dollar cost average down a little bit and help you with the basis. But, you know, if you keep it for longer term and you truly believe in the company, then, you know, whether you buy it this week or next week shouldn't make a big difference.
Right. Well, because the company ostensibly is not going anywhere if you're really believing it. Now, if you're trying to be a trader, if you're trying to time your entrances and exits, that can be a lot more difficult, because what a lot of people forget is that even, you know, firms like ours that manage a good amount of money, or even, you know, bigger firms that manage even more money, are competing against the really big boys, right? Those billion and 12 billion and 100 billion dollar firms that are pushing those, you know, they're buying and selling. And if you get in front of or behind one of those trades, whether or not, you know, depending on how you're looking at it, right, could be really poor, and you could end up really badly getting burnt, right? If you're trying to time in and out, and it, you know, no one knows if the market's going to go up tomorrow. No one knows if the market's going to go down tomorrow. Well, we all know it won't go up tomorrow, but because it's the weekend. But if, you know, we don't know when the market opens again on Monday, if it's going to be up or if it's going to be down or if it's going to be sideways, but we do know it's going to be one of those three things.
Yep. Process of elimination.
Right. And even on some days when the market's up, you know, so one of the things I used to say, Matt, you know, when people would ask me about how we keep up with market news, or, you know, how we look at things, that, you know, because they assume that guys like us are just up every morning watching the news, watching CNBC or Fox Business, watching to see the tickers rolling by on the bottom there. They're seeing if they think that we are constantly trying to, you know, time things. But really what we're doing is, you know, I tell people, I watch, you know, when it was on, I used to watch Mike and Mike in the morning, which is, it's a sports show on ESPN, because not that I'm not paying attention to what the market is doing. You want to pay attention to what's happening in the market, but you also want to make sure that you are not, you know, overwhelming yourself with this information that comes out to you, right? Because if it bleeds, it leads is a phrase that I've used a lot, right? Mostly because it rhymes, but also because those channels, those shows are trying to keep eyes on them. So if they are telling you, well, the market's up a little bit, not really anything exciting going on, nothing to see here.
Everybody would tune away.
Who's going to tune in? No, but it's when it's look here.
Breaking news.
Yeah. How many times do you see the breaking news ticker go across the bottom of the screen?
And Justin,
it ever actually breaking news?
Normally it's not.
Right?
Rarely.
It's stuff.
And if it's truly breaking news, there'll be, you know, like confetti falling off your TV, basically.
Right.
Otherwise, you know, just hard to get your attention to it. So.
Right. Well, so you got to pay attention and look at, it comes back to our, you know, our long-term goals, which, you know, we've been having that conversation with several of our clients, right, is to focus, if we can refocus on our long-term goals rather than worrying about what is happening in the, you know, in the near term, what happens today or what happens tomorrow. We need to have a focus on what's happening long-term. How does this affect whether I can retire next year? How does this affect whether, you know, my spouse is going to be able to continue on after I'm gone? Those sort of things, and reframe it so then it stops stressing you out so much, right? Because if you're an individual investor, unless you are employed as a trader, unless you're really getting, you know, amped about trying to beat the market, which in which case more power to you, right? You know, go out and do you. But most folks aren't really looking for that. They don't want that stress of having to worry about the market's up, the market's down. You know, I hear so many people that during this pandemic have started, you know, trading day trading or trying to be a trader. And while it can be really fruitful, it can work out really well. It can also work out really poorly, but the main thing is you're going to have added stress in your life.
Yeah,
right?
Most people also have, you know, day jobs of some sort a lot of times, and so it's hard for them to keep up during the market. I mean, that's part of the reason why, you know, you and I aren't sitting there in front of a screen with the tickers going all day, because we have, you know, meetings with clients and reviews and things we're taking care of. So, you know, and even Matt, our chief investment officer, he looks at things, and so he knows what's happening, but, you know, he looks at it from, you know, longer term perspective, you know, day in, day out. You know, he might be looking at some specific things, but nothing that's, you know, got to get done that specific moment. So
right, and making sure so it's not an emergency situation. Right. I got to buy or sell. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're not watching Cramer, you know, Mad Money on there, where he's, you know, the buy thing, but he, you know, they're still looking at it from a long-term perspective.
And we hear Matt saying that sometimes, you know, if a certain benchmark hits a certain number in his mind, that's when he's going to start looking at things. But that's where he sets those goals up in ahead of time. So he'll usually have those numbers written down and thinking about it. And so he'll pay attention. But, you know, it usually says, oh, once it hits this level, I'm going to see where it goes. and then, you know, come up with plan B. So it's not like, hey, once it hits this level, I'm going to, you know, buy or sell real quick because, you know, new data will be available because we only know what we know as of today. You don't know what's, you know, what's right. going to happen in a couple of weeks even.
Yeah, you don't know what kind of news is going to come out tomorrow that's going to send it the opposite direction. You don't know what kind of, you know, tax implications will come right. out, any of that sort of stuff. So, you know, if you haven't reevaluated your portfolio in a while from that macro perspective, if you haven't looked at how that affects your long-term goals, as a reminder for our radio listeners, we do a complimentary no obligation review where we take a look soup to nuts at your entire portfolio, right? We sit down with you, we go from where you are, where you're trying to go, and how we can help you get there. And if it makes sense for you, we're happy to work with you. But worst case is you spent an hour or two of your time, spoke to a professional, and taken a second look just to analyze what you've been doing and what you might be able to optimize. So if you'd like to do that, if you'd like to set up that review with our team, we do that virtually over Zoom. We do those in person where we're all practicing social distancing, using masks, or we do it over the phone, whatever is more convenient for you. Here, as one of our radio listeners, and you know, I like to say we're broadcasting to the Portland metro area, you know, generally speaking here across the Pacific Northwest, but we have clients all over the country. So don't feel like if you're not a Portlander, you can't have that complimentary review. It's something we enjoy doing and people find a lot of value. So give us a call, 503-253-3000 if you'd like to talk through that. We're happy to talk with Roth conversions, tax planning, estate planning, investment management, any and all of those items. Once again, it's 503-253-3000 or visit pfgwm.com. And with that, we're going to take a break and we'll be back with Taylor Cattell is going to join us in the studio to talk about covering your assets. We'll be right back with Investing Simplified.
Are you concerned about your retirement income? Do you really understand how your Social Security benefits work? Price Financial Group Wealth Management has helped many seniors in Oregon and Washington maximize their Social Security benefits at retirement with their Social Security Seminar on Demand. Now, you can watch this valuable information in the comfort of your home by just going to pfgwm.com and click on the free Social Security kit. If you are serious about your retirement planning, you cannot afford to miss this opportunity. After all, you've invested your hard-earned dollars into Social Security all your working years, so shouldn't you get the maximum return you can get from those dollars? The future can be scary, and without a plan, that can be even scarier, especially when facing the unknown. What you don't know can hurt you. Get your free Social Security kit at pfgwm.com or call 503-253-3000.
We do Investing Simplified.
You're listening to Investing Simplified. Now, back to Bo Caldwell.
Welcome back to Investing Simplified. If you're just now joining us, welcoming in to the studio here is Taylor Cattell of KG Law Group. Hello, Taylor. Welcome back to the show. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Bo. It's nice to be back. It's been a little bit.
I know. Well, you know, we get questions that come in, you know, from time to time about estate planning. And I always say, hey, send in your questions about estate planning, about tax planning. And unless I have you or Kevin on, then I really shouldn't be asking people to send in those questions because I only know basically what, or if I get that question, I'll send you an email or send you a message and say, hey, can you answer this? So one of the ones I wanted to kind of cover, if you're all right with it, is we've had, I have this conversation a lot when I ask people, one of the main questions I ask in our first appointments when people come in to kick the tires with us or get their complimentary review is, do you have you done any estate planning? Do you have a will or right. a trust set up and all those things? And a question I get often is, it particularly comes after no, and then they say, well, do I need that? And how do I know if I need a will or a trust? Or, you know, I know we've covered it on the program before, but I think it's good to get it for people to get kind of a refresher, you know, not necessarily, obviously we have to put the caveat out there. This apply to your own situation,
right.
you know,
right.
but generally speaking, do you have, you know, is there a way for people to kind of think about whether they should be looking at a will or a trust?
great question. I get that often, and that's one of the very first questions out of the gate is, do I need a will or a trust? And the answer is, it depends. A classic lawyer answer. I wish I could give a straight yes or no on is a trust always necessary? But I'll start out by saying, if you looked on your search engine, if you just type into Google or Yahoo or whatever your preference is and say, do I need a trust? Every single result you get will probably say yes, right? All the articles are out there toting trust. And under some circumstances, some state laws, that is the norm. That is the way to go. If you have any estate plan, I'm not going to say it's wrong to do something else, but especially when you hear about some of the probate rules, and probate, just as a term, probate is just the court-supervised process of getting assets from A to B. So does it take some kind of legal authority that the court gives to transfer assets after somebody has died to their heirs or to the people that they've designated in their will? Typically, if you have a will, it means that probate is probably likely or necessary. So there needs to be some kind of authority that says, yes, it's okay. You've paid all the debts. All the creditors are satisfied. These are the right people. They're still living and they're entitled to receive these assets, right? That's all that probate is the court making sure that that's all done the right way and legally. Avoiding probate is one aspect of a revocable trust. If you have a revocable trust in place, you don't necessarily need court authority to distribute those assets. You still have to pay creditors. You still have to pay taxes. You still have to do all the administration aspect of it, but it's not supervised by a court. So court rules matter, and every state has their own court rules for what probate looks like. And in some states, as one example, how attorneys are paid. Attorneys are paid in some states as a percentage of the assets.
Interesting. So if probate, if I have to go through probate because my father passes away, he has a will, I'm trying to distribute the assets the way that he wanted. In some states, the attorney that we work with, which because you have to work with somebody at the court, right?
Most of the time, there's an attorney who's involved in the probate process. It's not mandatory, but it's usually more cost effective because it's really hard to muddle your way through. And the court clerks are going to say, we can't give you legal advice. We can't help you. And it's more expensive to fix. So usually it makes sense. Almost everybody has an attorney going through even a relatively simple probate process. So if you have a relatively simple probate process, but the value of the estate is, let's say, $2 million, then if you have an attorney who's paid a percentage of that, whether it's 1% or 5%, that seems maybe unfair.
Sure.
In Oregon and Washington, attorneys are paid hourly. So it's not as bad as in some of those states. So that's just one piece of the puzzle. Another misconception is that probate means the state gets your money.
Oh, okay.
Right. I don't know exactly where that comes from. I don't know of any state that is entitled to your assets just by virtue of you not having done a will, right? It goes to your heirs. But there's this belief out there, somehow a fear that the state of Oregon is going to get something, get more than they would otherwise. And at least where I'm licensed, Oregon and Washington, that's not the case.
Sure.
It will go to the people you've designated in your will. And if you don't have a will, it will go to the people entitled to it by law, not to the state, unless you really, truly have no living relatives that can be found. That's the only time that it could go back to the state. And that takes quite a bit to get there. So there's a lot of misconceptions about what probate is and what it isn't. But in some states, probate is a lot worse.
Sure.
Right? It is a lot more expensive. It does feel a lot less fair. And especially in the more populated states, it can take more time. And it can be a more frustrating process. There are more hoops to jump through. There are more requirements. You have to make documents fit the form that's required by the court, as opposed to a little bit more flexibility on the formalities of it. One example in Oregon, in Oregon, no matter what, you have to find creditors. You have a duty to pay the bills, right? The things that are due. But if you're going through probate, there's a requirement that you publish notice in a newspaper that somebody's died. You have to publish it three times, once a week for 3 weeks, and then you have to wait 4 months. And wow. That's where you've got these agencies that comb through the newspaper legal ads to see if anybody's died who owes money. So there's a number of these collection agencies, and if they see that somebody who owes the money has died, then they contact the personal representative or the attorney, and they sometimes file a claim in the estate proceeding as well. Okay. So it doesn't change. Most of the time, the people who come forward are people you know about.
Sure.
Right? You know that there's a credit card bill out there.
Right.
You know that there's a debt. You know that there's a mortgage, right? Those are not things that haven't come in the mail time and time again, or expected or recurring or whatnot. So it's not that often that we get a surprise from that, but it is this waiting period for things that are known about, and it is it doesn't change the duty to pay those bills, but it can feel like more of a process, and it can open up a fear that maybe you are going to have more claims than maybe you had known about. Now, the flip side of that is that once you close an estate, the personal representative is basically released from that liability and the door is closed on creditors.
Okay.
If you have a trust, it's possible that 20 years down the line, a creditor could come back and say, you still owe us money from this. There's no closing of the door.
Interesting. Even if you have, so if you have a trust, you know, and I don't want to slow your roll here because this is really interesting to find out the differences. But it's, so if I had a trust, my wife and I have a trust, and then we both pass away, the trust then, you know, is dispersing the assets. But so what if the trust disperses all the assets after you pass away, and then it's still open to creditors coming after things?
So so this is theoretical. It doesn't happen a whole heck of a lot. But let's say that the assets go to your kids. Okay. Let's just fast forward to make it simple and say your kids are adults.
Okay.
Let's make it simpler. Let's say you've won. Okay. So you have one adult child who received all the assets, and total assets, just making things up, that he received net was $1 million.
Okay.
So in theory, legally, the creditor could come back, and if they were owed something from your estate, then he'd be responsible to pay up to the amount that he received.
Wow. Okay.
So if the claim was for $20,000, then he would need to pay the $20,000.
Yeah.
Now, if everything he got from your estate was $10,000 and the claim was $20,000, he has to pay $10,000.
Okay. So, right? So your heirs aren't going to owe above and beyond whatever
they're not going to take on your debts their own, right? If it's insolvent. But most of the time when you think about these scenarios in an estate, that would have been the door is shut. You go forward, you have to reopen, you have to put up your own money to reopen that estate to claim this, and you have to go find the assets, and you know, the burden's on you. Creditor, you missed your window. On a revocable trust, there's no clear piece there. Now, they still have to find the assets and say that they were, you know, trace it and all of that. Yeah. So there's still a timeliness aspect of it, and a lot of arguments you can make one way or another. So there's more room for gray area here than the way I'm presenting, but there's some benefits to going through the probate process that a lot of folks don't talk about. That's not to say that on the whole, you know, on your standard straightforward case, that's going to be a significant change, right? For most folks, it's going to be the same debts that come forward, and a trust on the whole is going to be more flexible, more private, and easier to administer. But probate is not, from my perspective, this terrible, horrible, bad thing that's going to really dramatically change the direction or defeat your goals or whatnot. So, so from my perspective, and I know that was a lot of more detail on how probate works, but I think there is a lot of misunderstanding about what probate means. And really, a revocable trust is somewhat of a reaction to probate, right? Okay. Some of what I don't want that, so what's my other option? If I don't want probate, what's my choice? So when I do an analysis with my clients on whether a will or a trust makes sense, I start first with the nature of their assets, not the value. It doesn't, it's not how much do you have. It's how are your assets held?
Okay.
If you, the nature of your assets, let's say you've got a piece of property, let's say multiple pieces of property, but they're all in the same state.
Okay.
So if everything is in the state of Oregon, you're going to have one probate process. But then you're going to have all of it tied up together.
Right.
If you have, let's say, four pieces of property and they're all in four different states, you're going to have to go through probate in four different states.
Wow.
Four different attorneys, four different processes, all paying attorneys to talk to each other because you only have one original will.
Right.
So that gets filed where you reside. And then you have to get a certified copy with, you know, basically the court saying, yes, we release this for an ancillary probate in all three other states.
Goodness.
So it's exponentially more expensive.
Right. And one, time consuming and stressful.
And keeping track of that is really quite painful. So in situations where you have property across state lines, that is almost always for me a trigger to say a revocable trust is probably going to do you some good. Ideally, you'd put all assets but retirement accounts into that trust. But even if you just put your real properties, you're going to get a significant benefit.
Sure.
Some businesses are other flags for me to say the nature of your business can't afford a 6-week gap for somebody to run it, right? Your business will lose value if you don't have a strong leader the helm. Some businesses, that's not the case, right? If you don't have any employees, if it just has let's say a month-to-month rental and there's an automatic deposit and so for 6 weeks,
right.
and I'm just ballparking, it takes 2 to 3 weeks to get a death certificate, maybe 2 to 3 weeks to get court authority. So it could be anywhere from, you know, a month to 2 months, however long it takes, to get somebody who's appointed as a personal representative
right.
to say, yes, okay, now I can manage this.
Right. Well, yeah. If you have a business like mine or yours, right, where you're working with clients and folks need things done, and
right.
if you pass away and that nobody with authority is there,
right.
then it could really throw a giant
right
monkey wrench, to borrow the idiom. Right?
Exactly. Right. So having when you're an employee
mm-hmm.
or when you're retired, that's less of a factor.
Sure.
Those are some of the main things. And then the thing that comes up probably the most often is the desire for privacy and to make it easier on the person that they're entrusting.
Okay.
So if you were to ask me, Taylor, what would you rather be, personal representative in a probate or a trustee of a trust? Hands down, I would rather be a trustee of a trust.
Sure.
Right? I would rather have the choices and the flexibility and the timing and the privacy to be a trustee. So I say also often to my clients, when you're doing a revocable trust, especially when you're in the thick of it and you're trying to figure out the quagmire of a deed situation in order to transfer it to your trust, you're doing all the work now
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
with the information you have now to set it up to make it easier on the people who are going to have to do this later.
Sure.
So is it now or is it later? It's going to have to happen.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people, I think, do want to put their head in the sand and say, I'm going to be dead.
Right.
Right. I hear that all the time. And that's not invalid.
Right. Well, you are dead,
you
right?
You would be.
Yeah.
And it will work out.
Yeah.
But for those who say, I don't know that I have somebody who's going to be able to follow this,
mm-hmm.
or I just want to make sure it goes this specific way, that's where doing the work now can be a huge benefit later. But on the flip side, I have other folks who have most of their assets, say, in retirement accounts.
Right.
Right? And maybe they've downsized and they don't have any real property anymore.
Sure. Maybe they moved to a retirement community or
right, they're
55 and over.
Living,
and they're,
right.
Yeah.
And they're in a place where they're really trying to simplify.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
they've got an investment account and a retirement account and adult kids. And we can avoid probate for the most part through beneficiary designations, through just setting up the right system that
mm-hmm.
for what they want. Using a power of attorney to assist them if they were to lose capacity or have diminished capacity. And a will is there as almost a backup plan.
Sure.
Right? So a revocable trust is not going to do that client the same benefit as somebody who's very heavy in real estate across state lines.
Right.
So those are the things that I'm looking for when somebody comes in on the will versus the trust question is really how are we going to accomplish your goals? What process is the best process to get from here to there? We'll get you there one way or another.
Right.
Your documents, whether it's a will or trust, the end goal is going to be the same. But what's the process to get there and who's going to be doing the work?
Right. That makes a lot of sense. And you know what I hear from that, and I know I say this every time, but it behooves you to work with a trusted professional because there, what you just said, and I know enough to be dangerous about that, mm-hmm. but whenever I get that question, I say, ask your attorney, right?
Yeah.
I said, well, that's a question for when you meet with your attorney because it's so individualized, right?
It is.
But the big key, and I know that, you know, before we get out of here for a break, I just want to leave people with that what I fear and why I ask that question every time when I meet with any prospective client, anybody who's exploring a financial plan, because one core piece of it is having an estate plan. It's having a plan, right? It doesn't mean it's having a will or having a trust. It's you don't want to have the word is intestate, right? If you pass away without it. And so I think that's where maybe people hear the intestate, meaning the state gets it, right? Because sounds right.
Maybe that's a good point. Yeah.
But the key is not that the state gets it. It's that the state decides what happens
to
your stuff.
The state has a plan for you if you don't have a plan for yourself, and that may or may not be what you want your plan to be.
Might not line up with it, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, so if you have a question for Taylor, if you have a question about estate planning, about, you know, different ins and outs, you know, the caveat always is we can't give individualized legal advice, but we can talk generally speaking or, you know, sort of if it were us, send that question to askbo@pfgwm.com. That's askbo@pfgwm.com. And Taylor, if people have questions for you or your team, they want to sit down with you and kind of go over options, how do they get a hold of you?
Best way is to call us at 503-878-8948, or you can find us at kglawgroup.com.
You can also visit pfgwm.com, and our trusted experts page has Taylor's face on there and her contact information. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more Investing Simplified.
Legal matters are never easy, but they are especially difficult when they involve the most important people and aspects of your life. This is Taylor Cattell, founding partner of KG Law Group. It's important to have an attorney who cares about your unique circumstances and knows how to get the outcome that is best for you. At KG Law Group, we specialize in estate planning and family law, including wills, trusts, powers of attorney, guardianship, and divorce. At KG Law Group, we provide both expertise and compassion as we guide you through the complex legal landscape. We balance knowledge of the law with exemplary client service. Whether you're reacting to a crisis or planning for the future, we are here to help. If you need legal advice, give us a call today and schedule a consultation at 503-878-8948. That's 878-8948. Or visit us online at kglawgroup.com. That's kglawgroup.com, serving Oregon and Southwest Washington. KG Law Group, your family, your legacy.
Got a tough estate tax or financial problem keeping you up at night? Ask your questions free at investingsimplifiedradio.com. That's investingsimplifiedradio.com or by emailing askbo@pfgwm.com. You're listening to Investing Simplified. Now, back to Bo Caldwell.
Welcome back to Investing Simplified. If you're just now joining us, thanks for being a part of our show. Matt, you know, we just got finished with Taylor talking through, you know, wills versus trust. That's a common question we get. But one question that I get a lot, and, you know, it's not my bailiwick, it's not the thing that I'm strongest in. So I'd like you to maybe share if you're okay with it here on the program. But, you know, there's been a lot of talk with interest rates being so low and seeming to stay low, at least for the foreseeable future. But is now a good time to refinance my mortgage? And if so, you know, what do we look for in a refinance on a mortgage? What sort of things should I watch out for?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it comes up quite a bit. Rates are at an all-time low. My younger brother actually just is looking to purchase a place, and I believe he got somewhere below 2.5% for a 30-year mortgage. It's pretty insane. So
wow,
Yeah, it's really good. But, you know, people want to know, hey, do I refi? Do I wait? You know, maybe you just refinanced a year ago, 6 months ago. It's like, oh, man, the rates keep dropping. So kind of a rule of thumb that I've told people before is around 1% of a rate drop is where you want to be, because then you're seeing enough of a difference in your payment and interest you're paying where it makes a little bit of sense. Could be a little bit less, though. So it kind of comes down to the math. So a couple things that, you know, I wanted to kind of go over. So number one item that everybody should pay attention to is closing costs, right? So, you know, a lot of times you see it on the statements and they can be confusing when you're working with the mortgage. Now, they don't do it on purpose. They've actually developed a uniform table for mortgages. So where if you go to different companies or brokers, they'll all have a very similar looking table and it breaks down the closing costs. But even then, they can be kind of tricky to read. So in the closing costs, what you'll typically see are a couple things. So one, you'll have the fee that the mortgage company is charging. It's usually called an origination fee or an underwriting fee or something. And that's really what the company is getting paid to do your loan, right?
Okay. The origination fee?
The origination fee, yeah. And then after that, you've got the typical, call them junk fees, but you got the title fees, which basically the title company takes to make sure your loan's recorded properly and then things on the title that shouldn't be on there. And the next item on there is what I call, and some people in the industry call it, prepaids. And so that trips people up sometimes because it can be a bigger number. But what prepaids really mean is that you're prepaying your mortgage, your property tax and your home insurance.
Right.
Two items that go in your escrow. So you may think, well, I already have an escrow and I'm refinancing. Well, the way that mortgages work is they'll wind down your loan, they'll close it and pay it off. Then they'll set up a whole new loan, even if you're with the same lender. And so what they'll have to do is they'll have to refund you the escrow balance that you have in your old account. And then the prepaids will basically refill that bucket. And so what'll happen is, you know, you might have a big number there for prepaids that you end up paying in. But then as soon as your loan's paid off, the old loan, you'll get a check in the mail for the difference. And so prepaids can confuse people. If you don't have an escrow account and you don't know what I'm talking about, escrow is basically your homeowner's insurance and taxes, and it's attached to your mortgage payments. A lot of people will have, you know, obviously everybody has to pay principal and interest, but then you have an escrow, which basically lets you collect your taxes and your insurance over a year, so it's not as big of a payment once. And a lot of companies actually require it nowadays to have an escrow to make sure the property taxes and insurance get paid. But after prepaids, the other item you want to look out is points. And so, you know, people get confused about those and sometimes they're not quite explained well. But basically what points do is they buy down your rate. So if you have a $300,000 loan, 1 point would be $3,000 and it'll lower your rate. Now, it doesn't lower it at a point. It usually lowers it by 1/8%. So what you want to do is look at a couple things. If you're refinancing, maybe you're heading into retirement, and we run into this all the time when we do financial plans. I mean, we had a discussion this week with a client where they had a mortgage. Like, do I keep it? Do I pay it off? Do I refinance? And so you want to look at the cash flow. I think if you're going in retirement and saying, okay, if I have this 30-year mortgage and let's say I'm paying $2,000 a month and maybe the refinance will save me a couple $100 a month, is that good? Is that good enough? Is it going to help me in retirement to maybe pay for a bill or something, something that,
or just puts less stress on their investment portfolio, their IRAs, that, you know, maybe they can take less out of their investment portfolio and subsist more on Social Security and maybe a pension if they have a smaller payment.
And it doesn't mean a retirement. I have a client that we're working right now with, and he just refinanced, and I think he's $300 or $400 a month he's saving, which is substantial. And he'll end up taking that and funding his wife's IRA for the year.
You know, there you go.
A little bit at a time. Well, it won't be fully funded, but it'll help. Kind of throw that in there. And so, because if you're saving money, a good idea would be to put it to good use and not just, you know, go spend it on something else.
Right. Well, that's what I tell people a lot, is if they're going to pay off the mortgage, or folks will ask me, well, does it make sense to pull money out of my investments to go ahead and pay off this debt or this, you know, this liability, this mortgage? And generally speaking, right, it's yes. Generally speaking, less debt is better, right? There's no good debt, you know, when we're talking about debt. Like, having no debt is ideal. But that doesn't always apply, and it's not always possible, right? Not everybody's walking around with $400,000 or $500,000 in their pocket to buy a house. But right. what I tell people, mm-hmm. and tell me if this sounds crazy to you, but is if you're going to take $10,000 to go pay off the rest of your car loan, I think that's great because, you know, maybe you have 5 or 6% in a loan, right? So, okay, we're going to go pay that car loan off, so let's not pay the interest to the bank. But what I see happen all too often, similarly to getting a mortgage paid off or getting their car loan paid off, is then they're not saving more. You know, their cash flow isn't helped. It's now they can spend $500 a month more because they're not spending it on a car loan. And so if you're going to do that, make sure that you're having a conversation with a planner about how you can pay yourself, right? I don't want to pay the bank if I can help it. I don't want to give them interest payments, but why not pay yourself those payments and force yourself to save? Because that is the positive from having a mortgage payment or a car loan payment conceivably, right? Is that you're not spending the money on things you don't need.
Yeah. And it sort of happens that $500 a month you just mentioned is $6,000 a year. And that just happens to be the annual amount you can put in an IRA if you want
to. Right, or a Roth. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah,
and, that wasn't pre-planned either. Good thinking. But the number finally got rounded up because it used to be $5,500. It was hard to divide that by 12. Yeah. But the other item that you think about is what's called a break-even analysis too. So what you want to do is add up those costs. And like I said, maybe keep the prepaids out of it. But add up the cost you're paying and how much you're saving on the rate. And then, you know, figure out how long will it take you to recoup those costs by, you know, dropping 1%. And then you couple that with how long will you stay in the house? Because if you're thinking you're going to move or sell the house within the next couple of years, it may not make sense to have the cost of refinancing, because once you move, you can't sell the mortgage to somebody. You're going to have, it's going to get paid off, and you'll get a check hopefully at escrow for the equity you have, but then you move on. So, you know, we don't know for sure where you're, you know, not everybody just lives in the same house for long periods of time. But if you have some degree of certainty that you'll be in your house for a while, then, you know, refinancing makes sense for a lot of people right now. Last caveat I'll throw out there, and then we can move on to part B, where I have another question and suggestion, is if you're thinking about refinancing and you're heading into retirement, I would almost encourage you to consider doing it before pulling the trigger on retirement, just to ease yourself the paperwork you would have with the mortgage company. You know, they're happy to do loans and refinances for retirees. It's just a little bit more convoluted because you kind of have to come up with all the documents to show your income. Where is it coming from? What kind of assets you have versus if you're working, you know, W-2s and taxes, you usually do it.
It's a little bit easier that way, right? And you mentioned, I think before we move on to the next question you have about mortgages, I think is an important one, is to touch on that break even again, just because what you mentioned was, you know, you went kind of fast through it. But so what I hear when I'm analyzing, hey, if I'm going to think about refinancing, there's a break even point of how long I have to stay in that house to cover the closing costs or the costs you covered, closing costs, maybe points, maybe prepaids, right? So if I got to pay $30,000, I'm just making up a number for easy math, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's say there's a $30,000 in closing costs. I have to make that up. And if I'm saving $500 a month, just easy math again, right? It's going to take me 5 years before I break even on that difference, right? Because $500 a month that I'm saving, $6,000 a year divided into $30,000 that I spent, that's 5 years. And I picked those numbers especially because it's easy math for my brain. But ideally, that's kind of how you look at it, right?
Yeah. No, that's exactly how you look at it. Hopefully you don't have $30,000 of closing costs on a mortgage, unless it's a really large loan. But yeah, that's exactly what you look at. So you want to say, you know, and by knowing how long you'll stay in the house, you can see if the break even makes sense. And so you want to have a positive number that you have a return, you know, after a while, every $500 you save ends up going in your pocket truly versus just recouping the cost you had on the front end. So yeah, it's a pretty simple calculation. If you're working with a mortgage professional, I would challenge you to definitely ask them that question. Say, hey, could you break this down for me? How long will it take me to recoup my costs? And they should be able to do that pretty easily. And they should have calculators for it. And, you know, you want to work with a professional that's, you know, upfront and honest and obviously discloses all of that information. So that'd be a good test to put them through. So,
yeah, so this is a good question. And, you know, those are good questions to ask. You know, and I'm going to derail you because I know you have thoughts. Your own thoughts on if we, you know, another question about, you know, length of mortgage. It looks like I'm spying over
reading
on
upside down on
reading upside
notes.
Down on your notes. But my question, you know, comes, you know, when you're looking at you know, more doing, going and getting a mortgage? Is it better, generally speaking? I know you're not asking you to, to tell me specifically, but, you know, have you seen in your experience that, you know, working with a broker versus going to the bank makes a big difference for people? Or, you know, what has been your sort of general rule of thumb with that?
That's a good question, you know, and not to, you know, one, they both have their pros and cons.
Sure.
You know, with a mortgage broker, the advantage I guess they would have is they may be working with multiple lenders, so they sure. can kind of shop your rate and potentially get you a better deal. But then the drawback on that is your loan may end up getting sold a couple times, so you might move lenders with the broker sometimes. Now, you know, as long as you're organized, you get the new paperwork, and the companies usually they're all pretty reliable, the information will still get to you and you can make your payment. With a mortgage person at a bank or credit union, they'll usually hold the loan themselves, although they end up selling it once in a while also. So it's one of those. Rates tend to be maybe slightly in the favor of brokers, just because of the fact that they do shop multiple carriers, and sometimes they have, I would say, you know, lower margins that they're after. So
sure.
I would kind of bring it back to, and we've had this discussion before, if you trust someone and you're working with them, you have an ongoing relationship, the difference in costs shouldn't be the deciding factor all the time. If we're within an eighth or a quarter of a percent difference, or just a few thousand in costs, but you're very comfortable with one person, and maybe you've got some that gut feeling that you may not be as comfortable with the second person, I would go with the person that you trust and you rely on, because, you know, after, you know, the break even, you can throw that in there. It won't make a big difference over time, but, you know, you'll feel good about it, and then you can go back to them for more business. And, you know, that's probably what I would do.
Okay. So number one thing is finding somebody you trust. I'm sensing a theme when we talk about asking questions of advisors, asking questions of CPAs and attorneys. That makes a lot of sense. Well, I'm going to take our last break here. Just, I know we have another question about that came, you know, that you've gotten over time about length of loan, and want to cover that. And we actually had some follow-up questions from last week's, you know, show and last week's topic. So we'll cover those here in our last segment. But I want to remind you, if you have a question about your financial situation, if you want to have our team review your mortgage, if you're kicking around whether or not to refi and how that's going to affect your long-term plan, I continue to go back again. It all depends on the plan that you have and what your goals are and whether or not it makes sense, because there's no right or wrong answer. There's only more data that we can give you so you can make a decision about your money and your financial future. But if you'd like a, you know, that professional second opinion, give our office a call, 503-253-3000. We're happy to sit down with you virtually or in person to go over your specific situation, can tell you what we think, tell you what we see out there, and connect you with a mortgage broker or another professional that we know that will take care of you if you're looking for a referral to that, you know, to in that vein. So give us a call, 503-253-3000. We'll be right back with more Investing Simplified.
Hello, this is Kevin Stege, shareholder with Baker & Colson Certified Public Accountants, serving the Portland and Southwest Washington areas for almost 40 years. We are a full-service accounting and consulting firm offering our services to a wide range of business and individual clients. One of the largest expenses to a household or a business is its tax burden. While off-the-shelf tax products can help file simple returns, they can't know your plans for the future and not only provide insight and planning to help you get there, but actually help you along the way. There are just some things that can't be replaced by experience. Whether you are just beginning your working career or have a well-established business with many employees, rely on the professionals at Baker & Colson to help in an efficient, accurate, and personalized manner. We're located at 2414 Northeast Division in Gresham and can be reached at our website at bakercolson.com or 503-666-5569. That's bakercolson.com, 503-666-5569. And remember, at Baker & Colson, our service is the product our clients remember most.
You're listening to Investing Simplified. Now, back to Bo Caldwell.
Welcome back to Investing Simplified. If you're just now joining us, thanks for tuning in for the last few minutes here. And we just have some last couple of questions, Matt, that I want to, you know, get answered. First, I know we had a follow-up question from a listener about last week's show, but before we get to that, I wanted to ask you the question, and I'm stealing your thunder because it's on your paper here, but I want to know, you know, is there a rule of thumb, or in your experience, have you found it, is it better to do a 30-year mortgage or a 15-year? If anybody's like me, if you're like me, you get these notices popping up on your phone or on, when you're surfing the internet, says refinance to a 15-year rate. And, you know, it's coming from, for me, it's Quicken Loans that, you know, that gets me that that's who's sending me those ads. But, you know, you're getting it from any sort of mortgage company, right? But so is it better to be 30-year or 15-year or kind of, you know, how do you think about that?
You know, as much as I'd love to just say one way or another, I think the answer is it depends.
Sure. As it so often does in answer case to the questions case. On this show.
But just a couple of thoughts. So if you're a first-time homebuyer, I would say a 30 probably makes more sense just because it's your first house. You want to have a payment that you're managing and you're not used to the other expenses that people don't consider when you're purchasing a house, you know, a leaky roof or maybe some issue with, you know, you want to paint your house or other expenses. So new homeowners probably a 30 most of the time. Although, you know, if you're up for a challenge, 15 would work too. If you're heading into retirement, you can either really go either way, but typically if you're carrying a mortgage into retirement, you're probably going to opt for the longer term 30-year because you want to have improved cash flow. As you mentioned earlier in previous segment, that you want to have, you know, less cash going out. So that way your retirement accounts, investment accounts are growing and you're not pulling quite as much out of those. If you're, you know, call it 10 to 15 years prior to retirement and you feel like, hey, I don't want to carry the mortgage into retirement, then going from a 30 to a 15, it could get you there. And it would be one of those things where it's almost forced, because if you go to a 15, you know, a 30-year mortgage, you could pay off in 15. 15 only pays off in 15. So you're kind of forcing yourself.
Sure. It doesn't give you the out to just accelerate payments. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, so those things are mainly the things you're going to consider. Now, you're probably getting pop-ups on the internet, and some of your lenders may be messaging you saying, hey, you can save X amount of money. But then the other thing that comes up all the time is, you know, with all these savings, if rates dropping, you know, if you can get a 15-year mortgage that's, I mean, in the twos, and you're going maybe from 3.5-4%, I mean, you're dropping, you know, we were talking 1%, you could be dropping 1.5-2%. So it could be to where you're dropping enough in interest that your payment on a 15 will be just slightly, you know, above what you were paying on the 30. And if that happens, I would, you know, I'd give it a strong consideration because, hey, you've been paying on a mortgage, let's say for 5 years, you have 5 years left, and then maybe you can cut off 10, not see a difference in your cash flow. So that'd potentially be another reason why you know, one of the depends situations. But, you know, we evaluate this for clients all the time. You know, it's case by case. It all depends on, again, the inputs and the outputs. What do you want to in retirement? What does that look like? What assets do you have? What do you want to carry into retirement? So it all comes back to that.
It makes a lot of sense. And so, I mean, the key is making sure you're doing the deep dive analysis. And I think the thing we got to put in there, we were talking about in the break, the caveat I have to put in there is we do not do mortgages. We're not saying get a 15-year or get a 30-year. What we're saying is maybe it might make sense to analyze whether a 30-year or a 15-year makes sense. We're not casting aspersions on any particular mortgage broker or telling you to go any place. We don't provide mortgages. We work with folks who do, and we're happy to provide that any information that might be a part of that, right? So you said there was a, you know, to get off of the super fun mortgage topic.
Yeah, it's a hot topic though.
Yeah, well, with the interest rates staying as low as they are, and that's the other thing I'd say, and you can provide your 2 cents on the outlook on it, but I think I don't see interest rates going up.
Yeah,
right.
So that's a very good point. I don't see them going up either. And so with that said, I wouldn't be in a rush to run in refinance tomorrow. I would take the time to analyze things maybe with someone, think about it, and then go in.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. So I know we've only got a couple minutes left here before we get out of here, but I know there was a question.
There was a follow-up to our discussion about the $15,000 exclusion donating funds. And so the question is a two-part question. It was with regard to a spouse. So if you're married, can you gift your spouse $15,000? And then part B, and this pertains to any of the cases we talked about, is the gift tax deductible?
Sure. Good questions, right? So number one, I'll answer the second part first. No, right? There's no tax deductible gift unless you're giving it to a charity or another 501c3 where you're giving it away. And there are rules that go into that. And there are rules that are changing soon, right? So it depends on the type of charity and it depends on the type of, you know, gift that you're giving. in terms of giving money to a spouse, you, the answer to that, right, is that you can give unlimited money to your spouse, and it doesn't have to be a deal, right? Because you're just giving money. You have an unlimited marital deduction is what it's called. So every gift, quote unquote, that you're giving to your spouse doesn't have to, you can go $15, $20, $45, $1 million. But the problem is it's not getting it effectively out of your estate, which is what most people are trying to do exactly. with the $15,000 exclusion. So if you're thinking about gifting money to your spouse, by all means, give that money to your spouse. And we can have Taylor and maybe Kevin have a more in-depth discussion on the differences between when you're estate planning or estate tax planning with yeah. a spouse and how you handle that. But in terms of lifetime gifting or while you're gifting alive, gifting to a spouse doesn't really help. So if you have a question about gifting, about lifetime gifting, about whether you can give it to your spouse or gift splitting, any of the things that we've talked about, including mortgages, give us a call, 503-253-3000, or shoot me an email to askbo, A-S-K-B-O, at pfgwm.com. Thank you so much for listening and tuning in. Be kind to each other. Be safe out there. God bless you all. This has been Investing Simplified. Price Financial Group, Wealth
Management. You can listen to past shows of Investing Simplified at pfgwm.com. This show was brought to you by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm with offices at 16100 Northwest Cornell, Suite 140, Beaverton, Oregon, 97006, and 7105 Southwest Barnes Street, Suite 175, Portland, Oregon, 97223. You can reach us by calling 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. Investing Simplified is a registered trademark owned by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated. Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Price Financial Group Wealth Management. We do investing simplified.